Welcome back to the weekly roundup with Dira De Boer and William McGimsey for RCR Talk. Welcome back, William.
Thanks, Dira. Good to be here again.
And every week we go through the key events from the past week. I should say every Friday afternoon you get an update on the key things that have happened. And we like to go into some depth on local issues and international issues. And sometimes we try and find common threads and try and draw parallels between what's happening here and what is happening overseas. Also, if you are watching this in video format, we are trialing a new system. So hopefully the product you get at the end looks really good. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that. And of course, you can let the technical team know as well. You can text on 2057 and email inbox@realitycheck.radio. And whether it's technical feedback or feedback on the political side of things or suggestions that you might have in for a future episode, we're keen to hear all of it. Now, the first item we'll get into is an international item that is also going to have some points of local discussion that has to do with election integrity. Now, in the United States, Trump issued an executive order on trying to increase election integrity in the United States, and that has been a very contentious topic in the last 3 years, hasn't it?
Yeah. So the claim that a lot of Republicans have been making, and Elon Musk and Trump partly as well, is that the Democrats, and this is something that a lot of Democrat authors have written about, they've called it the emerging Democratic majority, that the plan basically is they're going to have a lot of new immigrants come into the country and vote for the Democrats, and that's going to help them win elections. However, it starts getting a bit crooked when it's illegal immigrants, and when you don't have sufficient security around voting, and illegal immigrants may be voting along with other people. You know, the dead are voting in quite large numbers as well, is another one of the things that people talk about in America. And it's not just the voting. The numbers of people in various congressional districts contributes to the where the lines are drawn on the map for where the congressional districts are, and how many seats get allotted to various various places, you know, so how much representation, how many congressional seats in the various areas, yeah, how the Senate seats, how many votes you need to get to win those. So all these little things the population counts for. But it's the integrity of the voting that I guess is the main thing here. And the claim that Elon Musk has been making is that illegal immigrants are being voting. And of course, part of this is the laxity with which the paper ballots and the mail-in ballots are monitored. So if you've got illegal immigrants, you've got no ID, it's much easier to go and round up a bunch of signatures on these paper ballots and then drop them in at 3 o'clock in the morning if you're losing in a various at a certain polling place to try and rig the election. So this is the type of thing that people are worried about, that some people suggest happened in 2020. And it's the type of thing that these the reforms that Trump has passed with his executive order are supposed to resolve. It's supposed to stop illegal immigrants voting and stop some of the strange things happening around these paper ballots as well to ensure election integrity.
One of the main issues there is voter ID, essentially. Do you need to provide identification to prove who you are when you vote? And many countries have that. The United States, in many places, notoriously does not. New Zealand does not actually have voter ID either, although the ballots are double-checked. But of course, it's potentially an issue in New Zealand as well, where we should say, hey, voter ID should be required. The election should be tightened up. Yeah, it's the same. It's essentially a problem that we have here and in America, is that the electoral system itself and the electoral commissions try to get as many people as possible to vote. Right? They want to have more democracy, means that we just get more people to vote, and we just make it really easy for people to vote, because if we make it really easy for people to vote, then more people will vote. That's the theory. But of course, if you make it easier to vote, if you're trying to relax the rules around voting, well, then you're inviting more fraud. And that seems to be something that is something you want to avoid, of course, unless you want to win elections fraudulently.
So the fraud is a big issue. There's also the more you try and get more and more people to vote, the more you're expanding from people who are motivated and know something about it to people who are less motivated and who are low information voters. And if the quality of the electoral decision making has anything to do with how informed the voters are, then the more you try and expand the number of people who are voting into these low information voters who are less likely to vote, then presumably that affects the decision making in a way that makes the decision poorer. A second point I'd make around New Zealand is we actually allow permanent residents to vote instead of just citizens. And given the way our immigration system is run, we've got huge numbers of people here, large numbers of people, you know, applying for residency and all these sorts of things. We're treating the country a wee bit like an airport lobby. This gives us reason to be a wee bit suspicious of our own election integrity, and or at least cautious. And there's a question over whether permanent residents should be able to vote at all, or because what is citizenship really for if you're allowing your permanent residents to vote? What does citizenship really signify? I would have thought that a citizen is someone who rather than merely living in the country like a resident would, a citizen is someone who has some sort of stake in the country and therefore should, I think, have a greater ability to vote. So I think there's a question to be asked there whether we should still allow permanent residents to vote.
I think that it really should be something that should be tightened up in New Zealand. It would be actually great to see a political party advocate for this, to say, hey, we actually need to tighten up the franchise here in New Zealand, to say citizens alone should vote, and of course to actually have, you know, paper ballots, people turn up on the day to vote or turn up to the polling booths, instead of trying to expand, say, mail-in ballots, online voting. And we're actually seeing this with local elections, where local elections switched away from actually turning up to the polling booth to having to mail in a ballot. And they did this supposedly to try and boost turnout. But it didn't really work that way. Turnout continues to drop at local elections, as it really got nothing to do with the ease of voting. But now local government NZ has also said, okay, we need to allow people to vote online, because if people can just click a button and vote, well, then we'll have more voters. As you've said, if someone can just click a button online, then what's their actual interest? How are they actually really putting in any effort to be involved in making sure that their vote is used in a good way?
Yeah, and I think there's some problems that this raises, because in our local elections, they have very low turnout. And if you're simultaneously bringing in these tools to allow sort of online voting, and you know, you just go in on your internet and click it, it makes it easier for like highly motivated minority groups to basically come in, and it's not really rigging because it's within the rules, but they can come in and organize to win an electorate, or not an electorate, win a seat.
A ward or a council seat. And so on.
So it makes it increases the vulnerability that highly motivated groups who are willing to go around and organize a bunch of people to use these online tools and vote. It makes it easier for them just to pick off these council ward positions and get people in there who might represent their quite narrow minority interests. So I think there's a vulnerability there that people have to look at as well.
It's interesting. You've mentioned the demographic situation a few times already. Winston Peters has actually hinted at maybe having an immigration referendum on asking the electorate, hey, what do you think about the immigration settings? And I thought about this in terms of the elections as well. As you know, the demographics, the immigration settings are actually really important because, say, a few percentage points can swing an election. As you say, in America has been the argument where the Democrats have wanted to import an electoral majority that hasn't really worked out for them, hasn't really worked out in their favor. But you could argue similar things that are done here in New Zealand, where sometimes you see seats shift at an election and you think, oh, why is that? This was a safe Labor seat. Why is it switching to National? And the only real answer you get is by looking at the demographics of that particular seat. And you see, oh, there has been a really high number of immigrants in this area, or maybe there have been a lot of people who have moved away because of other socioeconomic changes, all downstream from immigration. So there's actually a massive connection between those, between, you know, your elections, the outcomes of your elections, and your immigration settings. And we don't have a big illegal immigrant situation like in the United States, where they've got millions, like probably 12 million, maybe as high as 20 million illegal immigrants, and they're trying to actively deport. But all of this is something that has, as we've seen, has a really big impact on the outcome of the election.
Ethnic bloc voting is a significant phenomenon, and the more different ethnic blocs you have in the country, the more ethnic bloc voting you're going to get. And one of the ways that politics has changed, I'm not going to put a date on it, but one of the changes in recent decades has been the degree to which motivated minorities have been able to get their way over the majority. Because if you've got a highly concentrated group who have a really specific interest, they're more likely to invest their time, they're more likely to organize, and they're more likely to prevail over a disinterested and unmotivated majority. Most of the the identity politics movements, the civil rights movements that have happened post the counterculture in the 1960s have been like this. It's been highly organized minorities who have waged culture wars, who have done identity politics, and who have changed things on that basis. And if you're having more of these ethnic minorities and other types of minorities, religious minorities in the country, it's easier to appeal to them on the basis of specific issues that they might be highly passionate about, and to motivate them to vote on that basis. So I think that we're going to get more of this. We're going to get more ethnic bloc voting, more identity politics, more of these specific campaigns. And now with the changes to the local body elections, more specific campaigns in specific areas to get specific people on the board for specific purposes.
And just quickly, two more things on the electoral commissions that the local government NZ has made. One of them is basically to return to some kind of in-person voting at elections, which was, as I mentioned, basically completely removed from local government, at least where I am in Auckland. And the other thing they suggested, more controversially perhaps, is to move to four-year terms. And we actually have had the ACT Party try to do this for central government, putting forward a referendum to say, should we move to four-year terms? It's possible that this may include moving local government to four-year terms as well. That obviously has other ramifications, not directly relevant to us, but I think for the listeners, if you see all of this stuff going on in your changes to how elections are done in New Zealand, definitely something to keep an eye on. These are simply recommendations at this point, but there will be some push to have changes to how voting is done in New Zealand implemented. And unfortunately, I think not in the same direction as things are going in America, which is to tighten things up. Here in New Zealand, there's still a push to make the elections, as they would say, more accessible.
Yeah, there are some good reasons to expand the term to 4 years, the parliamentary term. I mean, the election years are basically a write-off and you can get nothing done. And a lot of the these days in the public service, they have quite long planning timelines, especially for large regulatory and legislative changes. And sometimes that just runs more than the three-year term. So having a four-year term should allow you to plan and implement significant legislative change within the one term. On the other hand, it means you can vote them out less often if you're unhappy with them. For a lot of people who are, I think there's probably an increasing number of people who are dissatisfied with parties on either side, who are dissatisfied with the electoral options in general. And if you have a four-year term, their ability to express their dissatisfaction by voting whoever it is that's in out is lessened.
One last Trump item here. He has also abolished the Department of Education in the past week. This is potentially a big deal. abolishing the Department of Education in the United States simply means that each of the states continues to run their own education system, and the Department of Education didn't actually run any schools. It basically just was there to funnel a bunch of money to progressive causes. If you think about it, a way to sort of subvert the education happening in the states. Do you see big changes, big improvements happening in the education sphere in America? And I guess in New Zealand as well, there hasn't been much movement on education changes, but whether or not you see that heading in the right direction as well.
Well, one of the key ways that left-wing people and woke people exercise control over the population is through controlling the education of the young. If you can control the education of the young, you can inculcate the young with your values rather than the values of your political foes, and you can have whole generations of people who are locked in and much more likely to vote for you. This is one of the main reasons why the left is so worried about social media, because social media gives people ideas that they're not getting from the education system. It's a second opinion that they weren't getting before. I off the top of my head, I forget the name of the communist who said this, but I think it might have been Lenin. He said, "If you let me control the education system, I'll turn them all into communists, and you have a communist, country forever." It's not the exact quote, but it's something like that. And there's a lot of truth in that. So abolishing the education department, putting it back to the states, it's much easier for left wingers, for socialists, for communists, for woke people to subvert centrally controlled organizations, because there's one central point of contact you have to infiltrate and subvert, and then you control all the downstream, all the subservient points. In a decentralized system, it's much harder, because it means you have to infiltrate and subvert all the state education departments and take them over separately. It doesn't mean that they can't do it and they're not going to try to do it, but it makes it much harder, and probably a lot of those education departments are going to not be under left-wing domination in the same way. And so non-left-wing ideas, more traditional ideas, ideas that are more in line with the parents and the people living in those states, will able to be taught to the children as a result. Doing this sort of thing, eliminating left-wing control of the Department of Education, is one of the most important things that can be done to fight wokeism and to fight leftism. We should do something similar in New Zealand. I would recommend that all Western countries have a look at serious reforms of their government education departments to try and fight wokeism.
And for New Zealand, I think the move towards charter schools, expanding the charter school system, basically gives us that more decentralized approach to education. It puts local either local businesses or local communities or say groups of parents and so on, churches, whatever else, people who are on the ground invested in the education of children in their particular context, and they're invested in the results. That is going to give you a better education outcome than say New Zealand's Ministry of Education trying to just have a churn out left-wing propaganda, wokeness, and everything else that we see there. The sexual degeneracy that they teach in schools, all of that doesn't get pushed up from the local level. All of that gets pushed down from the top.
Yeah, and it gives parents more choice. If there's more different types of curriculum, parents can send their kids to the schools they want. And over time, that gives an indication of the types of education that parents want and the types they don't want. And this is the biggest fear of the leftists who control the education system. They do not want those types of signals to be put out. They want to control every school so there's no choice, so that parents can't express those types of preferences, and so that it can't be known that they don't want the education that the education bureaucrats want to give their kids. So I'm very supportive of charter schools. I think we need more of this. I note that Labor has vowed to abolish them, and the discussion we've just been having here is why they're so keen to abolish them.
No, absolutely the case. I'll mention one last Trump thing before we move on. There was some polling done that was published by the spinoff. I can't remember which polling company ran it, but they've run a number of polls over the last 8 years tracking Trump support in New Zealand, whether people would vote for Trump. And this poll's a little bit different, not a would you vote for Trump, but do you think Trump is doing a good job in New Zealand? There's one demographic group that came out as positive, where Trump had a positive support. It was a plus 12% approval rating, and that, which means that a majority of this particular demographic thinks Trump is doing a good job, and that was men under the age of 40 in New Zealand. And you also had men under, you know, between the ages of 40 and 60 who were roughly split. I think it was minus 2%. And then, interestingly, the third next demographic, very heavily negative, still I think minus 30% approval rating, but was young women, women under the age of 40. And it was the older demographics, especially over 60 demographic in New Zealand, that viewed Trump, Trump incredibly negatively. So I think this is quite a huge endorsement of what you were talking about around social media, is that the demographics that are plugged into social media, able to get free access to information, are likely to view Trump more positively. The demographics that are plugged into the TV, which is basically a continuation of the Department of Education, but you know, for adults and the elderly, they are, you know, the ones that are plugged in very, very much biased against Trump because that's the kind of programming that they're receiving. So it's just very interesting to see that reflected in the statistics in New Zealand around views of Trump.
Yeah, so there's a bloke on Twitter called Nima Parvini who goes, he's called the Academic Agent, that's his handle, and he talks about the Boomer Truth regime, which is the sort of the moral values that have been taught to that generation of people that put, you know, something like John Lennon's Imagine as the best thing, and something like Adolf Hitler and Nazism as the worst thing possible, and this ethic has been taught in the schools, and you know, it's gone through, it's shot through everything in the media that these people have seen all their lives.
Yeah, it's educate, like it's not, it's from education to entertainment to media to sporting, even like every area of society reinforces this particular program.
Yeah, it's the air that we breathe, it's the water that we swim in. Sometimes we don't notice it because it's so all-pervasive. But there are groups of people now who have been traditionally sidelined by this sort of hegemonic ideology, this hegemonic value system, who have found purchase on social media and have found purchase in other places of the internet.
Like RCR as well. I was going to say all of our... you know, all of our boomers here, older people who may be listening, don't worry, you're the good ones. But it's very, very interesting to see when you look at these numbers across generations that you see such a big difference, which gives me some hope, especially that younger people are, you know, are viewing the world in a way that is going to be quite very, very different in a good way.
Yeah, any time that these ideas have anything like parity, the ideas that we believe in tend to do better. The reason they have to have such control over media and education and everything else is because their ideas can't win in a fair fight in the battle of ideas, so they have to resort to censorship and control and Orwellianism to get their way.
Speaking of control, I think we should now talk about the sentencing bill that was finally passed. The government has been moving this along since they first got into office. It's now over a year ago, looking at maybe nearly a year and a half into the current government. Changes to the criminal justice system have finally passed and are going into effect. The most important one here, and I'll just quickly go over the six items that we have here, and I'll ask for your views at the end. Most important one, I think, is capping the sentence discounts that judges can apply at 40%. So previously, judges would, you know, they'd give a starting sentence and then they would cut, you know, they would stack on mitigating factors and they would cut it down to like nothing. Yeah, 70% discounts, 80% discounts, things like that would happen. The next thing is preventing repeat discounts for youth and remorse. So again, they would just stack. If you were a youth offender, you'd keep getting the same discounts over and over again. And you could pretend to be sorry and get the same discount to your sentence. So these people are going to be spending more time in prison, which is good. They're also going to introduce aggravating factors when it comes to retail crime. So people who are, say, committing violence against Sole charge workers will spend more time in prison as well. The fourth point here is that they are encouraging the use of cumulative sentencing for offences committed while on bail, in custody or parole. Again, something that judges love to do is give concurrent sentences. So if you commit six different crimes and you get different sentences, you serve those sentences at the same time, which is completely silly and nonsensical. Anyone who's got a brain can figure out that does not add up, and it should add up. So hopefully we're going to see the judges actually forced to stack sentences properly. The fifth item here, implementing a sliding scale for early guilty pleas with a maximum sentence discount of 25% and reducing that down. So again, judges were giving massive discounts for early pleas. I see that working, or I've always seen that as working both ways, because if you give a big discount for a guilty plea, you might be, say, encouraging someone who's not guilty to plead guilty just to avoid all the trouble and then spend less time in prison. So I think this seems to bring that into a more reasonable point as well, where people also can't just plead guilty at the end when they know they're going to get convicted and then still get the discount. So all of this, unfortunately, is just that judges have gotten really bad at using their own brains, and Parliament is having to rein them in. And the final item here is they're also going to amend the principles of sentencing to include a requirement to take into account information provided to the courts about victims' interests. So both ACT and New Zealand First campaigned heavily on this. This is a fulfillment of that, of those coalition commitments that ACT and New Zealand First made, which is that victims' interests should be put first. That is now the law of the land. How the judges will work on that, we'll find out. And these are all hopefully small changes that have a big impact.
Yeah, so, I mean, so the big picture here is that justice and sentencing is another one of these areas where the experts, the established wisdom is just incorrect. The experts tell us, you know, that putting people in prison doesn't work, that when you put them in prison, they're more likely to learn bad habits from other prisoners and get out and be more likely to reoffend. This is the wrong way to think about it. You put people in prison, they can't commit crimes, and it keeps people safe. Most crime, especially serious crime, is committed by a relatively small amount of the population. And if you isolate them from the population by putting them in prison, you prevent them from being able to commit crimes anymore. And the best way of rehabilitating people to prevent them from committing crimes anymore is to wait until they get old, over 40. Once people are over 40, I don't know what it is exactly. I think lower testosterone levels, maybe a bit of wisdom or something kicks in, and they're less likely to commit violent crimes anymore. People don't like those ideas. They don't appeal to them. They don't appeal to people's warm-heartedness, their compassion. They don't appeal to their idea that people can learn their lessons and get better. But nevertheless, they're correct. You need to lock up people who have shown that they're violent criminals, keep them away from the population until they're too old to be a risk to anyone anymore. And that will do the trick if you do it.
You mentioned people who disagree with that view, and some of those people happen to be in the Green Party. And there was a Green Party MP this week who decided to come out and say that the police needed to be abolished. Not just a Green MP as well, but she is also the MP for Wellington Central. So she actually won an electorate seat. So this is quite rare to have, say, someone who has direct constituents, and Tamitha Paul from the Green Party is arguing that the police should be abolished and that basically people are afraid of the police, which is why the police need to be brought under control, I guess, is what she thinks. That if people who are engaged in bad behavior, that they may be afraid of the police. And so that's a bad thing.
That's dumb, isn't it? you need to have police to maintain law and order. Everyone who has any sense knows this. If you don't have police, criminals will run riot and have more crimes. This is obvious. We shouldn't have to repeat this. It's embarrassing that people can get into Parliament if they don't think that. Some people, give us some credit, there are sections of the population who do feel intimidated and unsafe and hostile toward the police. But that's because those people are the groups that tend to commit more crimes. And so their experience of the police is that the police come around and arrest their friends and arrest their family and so forth. And so they've built up a negative associations toward the police over time. Now, that's a reasonable sort of problem to think about. Are there things that we can do there with those sections of the community to try and mitigate those negative feelings that they have towards them? And perhaps one of the ideas that comes up is we should have the police that should police those parts of the community should be people from that community who can relate to them a bit better. And I haven't seen the evidence on that, but perhaps there's something to that, just to try and reach out and understand the point of view that's being expressed here. Let's think about this in another way. You've had some negative experiences with the police as well, haven't you?
I was just going to say, I'm one of these people who has had a negative experience with the police, negative experiences with the police. And my response is not to abolish the police, but obviously I want the police to do their job properly, to not harass innocent people, to not create trouble for law-abiding citizens, to not go and try and invent hate crimes, not to try and hope they can get lucky by the police advocating for law changes like on firearms and then go after firearms owners, hoping the police can sort of justify the laws that they themselves have advocated for. No, I just want police to focus on crime. I just want the police to focus on crime. So there are people who have a negative view of the police, like me. I do have a more negative view of them than I did before, certainly. But that could be fixed if they actually just did their jobs properly. And that's, I think, what people want from the police, is they want to see the police and they want to think, okay, cool, the police are dealing with criminals.
Yeah, I mean, if the police do what the police are supposed to do and deal with criminals, particularly violent criminals, and keep the streets safe, I think the vast majority of people are going to be very happy with that. But when they get off on these tangents about dealing with non-crime hate incidents, that's obviously going to antagonize a lot of people. It antagonizes me too. So I think less focus on non-crime hate incidents and more focus on non-hate crime incidents.
Yeah, and just one final example here for this Green MP, Tamitha Paul. She made a claim, for instance, that lots of people, the vast majority of people, were imprisoned for non-violent offences, and then claimed that somebody had been imprisoned for stealing $12 of value. She was asked to substantiate that story, provide some evidence. Well, that's interesting, stealing $12 and going to prison, because people commit all kinds of horrible crimes and don't end up in prison. And she said she didn't know. She couldn't provide any extra information. It was just something that she had heard somebody say. This is the kind of MP that you're dealing with. And the saddest thing is, I guess, that you have an entire electorate that voted her in as, to be their representative. Whether or not they will see the light next year remains to be seen.
Yeah, these are views that are the trendy. It's like a fashion statement. To it's like people, wearing the ridiculous clothes on the catwalk. These people are adorning themselves with ridiculous political views instead because it's fashionable in the circles they move in. And they live in, they live, the areas that they live in are less likely to be riven by crime. They're less likely to suffer the consequences of the bad policies that they embrace and support and push through the government so they can afford to get away with this. But it doesn't mean the rest of us should listen to them. And what it means is the rest of us need to push back very firmly with reason and evidence on these silly views.
Now, the final item for this week's weekly roundup is going to be around the State of the Nation speech that Winston Peters gave and the declaration of the war on woke. And also a new members bill this week from them on requiring referendums on conscience issues. So issues that, say, Parliament usually doesn't vote along party lines, ones where they say, well, each MP should make up his or her own mind. And usually these are around social issues. New Zealand First is saying that those kinds of votes should go to the people, not just to the MPs. What is your big summary here of what Winston Peters in particular, what New Zealand First in general are doing as they begin to position themselves, as it seems very much to me, begin to position themselves for a very early election campaign here, still a year and a half out?
Well, one of the things that worked well for them in the last election campaign was the cultural issues. And there are two brands of cultural issues. There are the set of issues around Maori stuff and too much Maori stuff. Too much Maori stuff in the government, too much Maori stuff to do with the treaty principles, too much John Taumahiri related stuff.
Yeah.
Then the second bit is the rainbow related stuff, too much trans related stuff, too much, drag queen story time, to the government doing teaching kids about gender ideology in the schools. And the government doing business with a lot of these rainbow advocacy groups. And so those are the two branches of woke stuff. And I guess DEI, the general view that the people who are in charge of our society and who are pushing this stuff down have views, woke views, that differ from the views of most normal people in the population. And when you're ruled over by people who have different views from you, that's kind of the definition of oppression, right? You're not being ruled by your own people. You're being ruled by people who have a different agenda. And sort of the classical political philosophy view, that's what oppression is. And that's the way it is now. We're ruled by people who have different ideological, political, philosophical, religious views from the majority of the population, and they're forcing this stuff down on people, and that is oppressive. And so I think he's right. I mean, it's a winning political issue for him to be talking about this. The issue is whether he wants the issue to help him get into power or whether he actually seriously wants to do anything to fix it. And, you know, there are some indications they're doing some things, they're making some progress on some issues, but in other areas, it's like, are they really doing anything to fix it? And I guess that's the frustration. We don't just want to be talking about this issue because it helps certain politicians or parties to get into power. We actually want to fix it so we can go back to having a normal country where we don't have this stuff, we haven't got the stuff being pushed down on ordinary people in a way that grates, and in a way that really oppresses and harms a lot of people, especially with some of the stuff that's happening with the transgender hormones and stuff that are given out. There's a lot of the stuff that isn't merely clownish and silly. A lot of it can be harmful as well. So we really need to get into gear and do something about this and fix it.
And as you mentioned, a good political strategy, and it seems to be potentially a two-pronged approach there, where New Zealand First is really doubling down on the wokeness as being from the sexual degeneracy, essentially the trans mutilation of children. That's a primary target for New Zealand First. Yes, they do talk about, as you mentioned, the Maori issues, racial issues, but the ACT Party seems to have made that their forte, and so you're seeing some political jostling for space and seeing, you know, is there big enough, you know, is there room for them both to speak to what probably is a big demographic overlap. As I mentioned already before, young men in particular are leaning towards Trump's policies. You see that Trump definitely pushing very much on both of those, meritocracy on the one hand, pushing against the wokeness, against the mutilation of children, the transsexualism. And also, though, this is where I think both ACT and New Zealand First are missing something, is a really important part of Trump's agenda is around that, the issue of immigration. And it does not really seem to be something that they want to engage with either. Both of these parties not really keen to engage in that. And I think they're leaving a lot on the table, especially with younger demographics who are seeing this more so as an existential threat of, okay, well, you know, are we going to have a country? Are we a real country? And that, you know, do we have a stable population? Who are our people? Who are the people of New Zealand? Who are the New Zealanders? And are their interests really being represented in Parliament? That, to me, is the thing that's missing from all of this.
I completely agree. So there's been a lot of progress in getting this idea of wokeness and the woke takeover of our institutions into the public consciousness. And wokeness is basically cultural Marxism. But there's a disconnect in New Zealand where we haven't connected the dots between immigration and cultural Marxist subversion. And the immigration is just another branch of the cultural Marxist subversion. It's a way of attacking Western civilization, Western norms, white cis heteronormativity, by bringing in a bunch of different peoples and cultures who disagree with many of those norms and are not of those people and are hostile to white Western Christian derived civilization. So this is all part of the same culture warfare being waged against Western civilization and the people and its people. So we need to join those two things together. The reason they're doing it is because the Marxists, they figured out that after a long time trying to appeal to the white working class to get them to, vote for them and support their plans, that the white working class don't support Marxism. They support nationalism more. So they're trying to replace the white working class with a new amalgam of people who don't have those patriotic loyalties and who will vote for Marxism. So this is, it's an evil plan, right? That's what they want to do. It's an evil plan. It's being advanced in the name of advancing their ideological program. And it's part of the same woke cultural Marxist agenda. So we need to recognize that this is a branch of that cultural Marxist subversion program. And we need to work to address it and reverse it as well.
And on that subject, I did do an interview with Martin Sellner from Austria this week, and he has popularized this concept of remigration in Europe that basically became a really big feature in the recent elections in Austria and also in Germany. It's a big issue in France as well, and in Belgium. There are even new political parties in Britain who are trying to raise this. Donald Trump mentioned this in the United States. So if you're really keen to learn more about this issue, I've already spoken to Martin Sellner about this. I would highly recommend you go and listen to that. And I think you will. I'll just mention lastly, what I've seen from both New Zealand First and ACT is an increase in the amount of attacks that they are making against journalists. So you see a lot of clips coming out from the social media teams of both ACT and New Zealand First, where both of the leaders, David Seymour and Winston Peters, are arguing with journalists. They're dunking on journalists, very much recognizing that they need to fight against the media. And that was something I remember commenting on last year, many months ago now, thinking, hey, they're treating the media sort of like friends they're on a level playing field. There seems to have been a really big shift in just the last few weeks and this last week in particular, where both of those party leaders are realizing there's going to be massive mileage out of treating the media, who are programming the electorate, as their primary enemies. And that's a really positive thing to see.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that Trump pioneered, is treating the media as if they were his primary political opponents rather than his political opponents. And that worked really well for him because the media are in many ways less popular than the political opponents. And so it always makes you look good when you're dunking on the unpopular people.
People forget Chris Hipkins even exists the moment you stop talking about him. And so avoid attacking Chris Hipkins, just attack his handlers and in the media instead.
Yeah, but it's inside baseball. People have sort of become aware of the fourth wall there, that the role the media were playing in shaping the narrative and influencing the game, tilting the playing field, the political playing field. And so once people are identified and realize that the media are political actors, then and they don't like the direction that their influence is influencing things, then they start to really like it when people challenge them. And so there's still a lot of the media in New Zealand are less popular, less trusted, and they have less influence than what they did. But they're still there. They're still doing their thing in a lot of ways. And so it's good politics to dunk on them, especially when they're promoting dumb views, asking you dumb questions. Why not give it back to them?
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me. We have run out of time for this week, and there's always more to talk about. So we'll come back next week And I'm sure that it will be an action-packed week. Thank you for listening to the show, everyone, and thank you for joining me, William.
Thanks, Stuart.